The crush of love parted from the Art of Noise and Company on the sidewalk outside Happy Seven. It wasn't a long walk up Spadina to the university, where they all lived.
"Drive safely," said Joe.
"Have a good summer," added Eric Arnoldson, the band's rhythm guitarist. "Hopefully we'll see you back in the fall." "There's a function room in the basement of Riley Hall, where I live," Azalin told them. "It used to be a pub back when the Institute was a college. Sometimes the Student Social Committee books bands in there. You guys should come down and play a pub show sometime." She nudged Caitlin with an elbow. "Kate's on the student council. She could get you in." Kate smiled.
"Seems likely," she agreed.
"Coming up on finals this year," said Joe. "But maybe this fall?"
"We come up here, you go down there. I like it."
Azalin framed an imaginary sign with her hands. "The Toronto-Worcester Cultural Band Exchange." Joe chuckled.
"Sounds good. Good night, you guys. Great show."
Be seeing you, Joe, said Kate, and the Art of Noise and Friends stood and waved as the other band disappeared up the street.
"Well, boys and girls," said Moose with a yawn you could have stuffed an entire birthday cake into, "it's past this Moose's bedtime. All aboard who's getting aboard for the Mississauga Motel 6. I hear we've even got multiple rooms this time."
Mickey stopped his watch. "The subtle science of reservations," he said with a smile.
"I wonder where Devlin's spending the night," said Wakabo with an evil grin and an elbow in Sionji's ribs.
"Someplace soundproofed, one hopes," Sionji replied dryly. Azalin pouted the pout of the left out. Juri just shook her head and sighed in mild disbelief. Utena and Corwin had been in some sort of conference under the streetlight next to his antique limo. Now they rejoined the group as it started to divide itself among the vehicles.
"Kate," said Utena, "do you mind driving your car back to Worcester tomorrow?"
Kate looked surprised.
No, she said, but...
She let her face ask the question for her. Corwin grinned. "I finally finished the wonder," he said. "She's over at YYZ.
"And you want to show off,"
Kate finished for him with a smile.
"Well,"
he rubbed sheepishly at the nape of his neck.
"Yeah."
All right, said Kate with mock reluctance.
But next time you visit... I want a tour, too."
"Sure, you bet. Bring the whole gang. Heck, you could come tonight. I ended up fitting four cabins. It'd save you some money on the motel rooms. I don't have the cargo space for both cars, though."
"We're already reserved," Kate told him.
You go ahead.
"I'll see you guys tomorrow, then?"
Utena handed the Impala's keys back to their owner. "Well, you'll see me anyway." Corwin nodded, then drew his sister up in a hug. "I'll have to leave before you get in," he said.
"Walk in glory, little brother," said Kate, the only Old Norse she knew, her traditional farewell for him.
"Live with courage, elder sister," he replied. "Goodness," she realized. "He's getting tall enough to kiss my forehead. Won't be long before he's towering over me. I guess I inherited Dad's short gene." Hugs, handshakes, and farewells all around, and then they split up. The van, Vlad the Impala, and Sionji's old Corley sidecar rig heading for the Mississauga Motel 6, and the Black Griffin bound for Pearson International Spaceport. The radio was playing an old swing song, and in the dim glow of the dashboard instruments, Utena could see the quiet little smile on Corwin's face as he guided the old car along the highway. She was tired from her long day, that happy sort of tiredness where you know that the sleep you owe yourself is just going to be delicious when you finally get around to having it.
In this contemplative mood, it struck her, not for the first time, how comfortable she felt with Corwin around. The situation was one which, given her past history, by all rights ought to have made her nervous, or at least tense. Alone in a car with a handsome fellow, speeding down a deserted highway at night. She should have been wading hip-deep through bad memories and the fear that history tended to be repetitive. Instead, she was perfectly relaxed, aware of every pleasant little thing around her, the restful sound of the radio, the coolness of the slipstream washing over the knuckles of her right hand where it lay along the window combing, the private little smile on Corwin's face, barely visible in the yellowish-green glow of the dash. Utna had no fear of him, not because she was confident she could defend herself if the need arose, but because she trusted him absolutely, not to make it necessary. There had been a time, not so long ago, when she had wondered if she would ever be able to trust a man like that again. Well, all right, Corwin wasn't really a man, not yet, but still. She must have dozed off. What woke her again was the sensation of the car gliding to a stop. "Well," said Corwin, gesturing, "there she is." Utna opened her eyes and looked. "Wow," she said. They were in a spaceport revetment. She recognized it from her voyages aboard Corwin's father's personal ship, Dagger Disc, which Corwin had been regularly borrowing to make his visits to Earth. In front of them, crouched on three stout landing legs, was a different vessel. It reminded Utna somewhat of Dagger Disc. It was about the same size, and like that familiar vessel, it was flat-bodied and broad. It had a sort of overall mechanical similarity. Many of the individual parts, like the quad-mount weapon turrets on top and bottom in the center, the landing gear, and the bullet-shaped cockpit, were the same. Where Dagger Disc was mainly circular, though, with a pair of odd mandible-like protrusions at the front and the cockpit off to the left. This ship was more wedge-shaped, point forward, cockpit to the right of center, with steep, sharp fins at the ends like stubby atmospheric wings. In fact, the whole thing was rather wing-shaped. Also unlike Dagger Disc, which was mainly bare armor with a silvery-white coloration, this ship was thermocoated in black, a glossy black that gleamed in the lights of the revetment, with silver striping. As Corwin drove around the ship to port, Utna could easily read the markings on its upright fin. HDK-8212, One Hit Wonder, New Avalon. The Griffin rounded the rear quarter of the ship, revealing, instead of Dagger Disc's wraparound three-section conformal ion thruster, eight big round fusion turbine exhausts, four on each side. They conspired with the fins and the forward-leaning look of the wedge shape to make the ship look fast and brawny, like a sports car with bulging fenders. Corwin drove the car onto the waiting cargo elevator aft of the forward landing gear, set the parking brake, and tabbed a control next to the console VDU. The elevator retracted, and there they were, parked in what looked for all the world like a garage. He trotted around to the passenger side to open the door for his guest, then conducted her through a power hatch and into the more personable section of the ship. It looked much like Dagger Disc inside as well, with the same sorts of fittings and subtle design features. Utna discovered the reason for this in the engine room, where there was a brass plate fixed proudly to the only part of the forward bulkhead that wasn't either an access panel or traversed by conduits. Corellian Engineering Corporation, she read aloud. Type 9 Space Freighter, YT-490 class. What's that relative to your dad's? Earlier, Corwin replied. Matter of fact, this series predates Seleucia's first contact with Earth. It's older than Dad. Wow. Utna looked around and grinned. Your family sure does like old stuff. They don't make 'em like this anymore, said Corwin with a grin, slapping a support beam as they made their way around a short, curving hallway into the ward room. You told Kate she was finished. You've been working on her for a while? Corwin nodded.
Dad and I found the space frame in a junkyard when I told him I wanted to take the master's exam. She was pretty much derelict. No windows, no engines, not even atmospheric integrity. He and Mom and Hiroshi have been helping me fix her up since last September. Ushna laughed and said with wry accusation, I stayed with you and your mom for a week, and you never said a thing about it. I wanted it to be a surprise, he told her. Just think, one day you might have a ship like this yourself. Me? Get real. I couldn't pass that exam. Not now, Corman acknowledged, but you're smart. If you wanted to, you could study up for it. Maybe not carrying a full course load, but if you did like I did and worked it during a summer... He shrugged. I've seen the way you react to space travel, he went on, worrying slightly that he might be stepping too far. I think you'd really enjoy piloting, master of your own destiny and all that. Just you, your ship, and the stars. It's romantic. She gave him an odd look. He blushed and added, not boy-girl romantic, necessarily. Romantic like, you know, swashbuckling. A lot of people think space travel is the only real adventure left. Ushna considered that and said, around a yawn, that she supposed she could see the appeal. If you decide you want to try it sometime, said Corwin, I'll help you any way I can. So would Mom, I'm sure, and Dad. She nodded, smiling, and said sincerely, I'll think about it. In the meantime, said Corwin, as her yawn proved its powers of contagion, here's your cabin. He tabbed a control on the corridor wall, and a narrow door swished open to reveal a compact little bedroom complete with a data terminal, a folding sink, and what proved, on closer examination, to be a sonic shower cubicle. It was like a sleeper compartment on a train, tidy and neat, everything in its place. It's a little small, but... Looks fine to me, Ushna assured him. Well, good night then, Corwin said. If you need anything, the intercom's by the head of the bunk. The green button in the upper left calls the captain's cabin. It's the last door on the left, he added, pointing up the narrow little hallway. Ushna smiled, gave him a hug, and bade him good night, then listened to the click of his shoes against the deck plates as he walked up to his own room. Beep swish, click, beep swish, as he went into his cabin, and then all was silent except for the soft, subliminal hum of the ship's power systems. Ushna dropped her duffel bag by the folding sink, changed into her pajamas, and climbed into the narrow but surprisingly comfortable bunk, then reached up to the control panel and switched off the lights. Just like camping, really, she thought as she drifted off to sleep. Worcester Regional Spaceport was a small facility, not heavily used. Only one commercial space line and two planetary airlines used it, all of them fairly small operations. Everything else was private traffic. Thus it was rather unusual that there were not one but two spacecraft wearing the colors of the Imperial Gamelon Navy present, a stubby Thardok-class scout ship and a sleek, deadly Lightning IV astrofighter. Our timing's pretty good, Ushna observed, pointing. Corwin noted what she'd noted, the three figures standing in a little group by the Lightning, and smiled. Good to see Carter still standing, he observed, locked down his panel, and got up to head for the garage bay. Well, kids, said Rena Dragonar airily, it's been fun, but my weekend pass is just about up. Time to hit the gate and head for my rendezvous with the flagship. She fastened the collar of her flight suit and tabbed the wrist control to pressurize it. Wouldn't want to keep Captain Doorknob waiting. That would certainly never do, Amanda agreed dryly. Rena went to the side of the fighter, punched a code into the access keypad, then yanked the collapsible boarding ladder down while the cockpit canopy whined slowly open. Turning to the other two, she smiled a bit more seriously. Take care, you guys. If you need me, just yell and I'll come running. Amanda, I wish you'd reconsider letting me stay here.
Amanda opened her mouth to reply, but Rena continued with a resigned grin.
But I know you won't.
She turned to Devlin, put a hand on his shoulder. So it's up to you, Carter. Keep her in one piece until she can come back to me.
Devlin smiled. I will, he told her. And while you're at it...
Rena pulled him close, kissed him hard, and then murmured,
Keep yourself in one piece, too.
I plan to, he replied. She grinned, punched him in the shoulder, then kissed Amanda goodbye and climbed up into the Lightning's cockpit. The princess and her companion backed away, past the yellow safety line, and watched as the pilot put on her helmet, checked her systems, then powered up the fighter, lifted off, and headed for the stars. They were standing there, hand in hand, watching the Lightning vanish into the blue spring sky, when Corwin's black car glided quietly up next to them.
Hey, said Utena through her open window. Give you guys a lift back to school?
Utena wasn't quite awake yet when, on Monday morning, she opened her mailbox in Daniel's hall to find a letter from the Dean of Students. Making a puzzled noise, she leaned her briefcase against the wall, opened the envelope, took out the letter within, and read. It was a personalized form letter, which accounted for the large number of WPI envelopes in the big trash barrel near the elevator, and it read as follows. Worcester Preparatory Institute, 100 Institute Road, Worcester, Massachusetts, Earth, Earth Alliance. 2405-03-28 to Tenjo, Utena, 2407-123. It pains me to inform all students of the unexpected retirement of Mr. Arthur Hanley, the Office of Student Assistance's student counselor. As you may know, Mr. Hanley has not been well for some time, but owing to his strong commitment to the good of the student body here, he chose to remain at the Institute for as long as he was able. However, over the weekend, his condition has worsened, and he and his doctors have agreed that the time has come for him to think of himself. Only with the greatest of effort has a replacement been found so quickly, but the administration considers the student counselor's position very important, far too important to leave vacant for the remainder of the term. It is, therefore, with great pleasure that I welcome to our academic family Miss Martine Leclerc. Miss Leclerc has an uphill struggle ahead of her, trying to become acquainted with the school's population without any time to prepare or review the student files. Therefore, I am asking all the students to help her by meeting with her for an informal, one-on-one session within the next 3 weeks. Your appointment is set for Thursday, March 31st, at 10:30 a.m. in Miss Leclerc's office at 204 Boynton Hall. Professor Farr has been notified, and your absence from Calculus 1, Part 4, will be excused. Please make every effort to be punctual. Miss Leclerc has a great many appointments to keep, and any tardiness by one student will disrupt her schedule for the entire day, inconveniencing everyone. Thank you for your attention to this matter. I know you will want to make Miss Leclerc feel as welcome here at the Institute as you can. Yours very sincerely, signed, Carlton J. M. Weatherwell, Dean of Students. Utena cocked an eyebrow, read the letter again, then picked up her book bag and stuffed the letter into it. Whatever. She was running late for Klingonese as it was, and Professor Krull got so grumpy when people wandered in late. Over lunch, the duelists compared their letters and speculated on their significance. The first one of them to have an appointment was Caitlin, whose time to meet with the new counselor was at 1 that afternoon, immediately following lunch. This sparked a digression into wondering just how the scheduling for these meetings had been determined, since they seemed to follow neither the alphabet nor student ID numbers. Finally, that thread was abandoned as unresolvable without more data, and Kate was tasked with letting the others know what this was all about. With that in her mind, she gathered up her book bag and walking stick and left a bit early so as to reach Boynton Hall promptly at 1. The admin building was the highest one on campus, surmounting Institute Hill like a gray-brown stone church with its clock tower and Dewar facade. Caitlin entered, climbed the stairs to the second floor, and found her way to room 204. That wasn't hard. She had met with Mr. Hanley several times the previous year, during her difficulties with her previous roommate. Arthur Hanley had been a good counselor, a pleasant, elderly man with a remarkably varied background, who had an anecdote for almost any situation and a way of putting students at their ease. Caitlin missed him, hoped his retirement would improve his health, and wondered what his replacement was like. This last, rather an academic thing to wonder, as she would find out in about 10 seconds. She knocked at the door and was bade to come in. The office was different. When it was Mr. Hanley's, it was wood-paneled and full of bookshelves, with leather-covered chairs and a big redwood desk. It had rather reminded Kate of the den back home in New Avalon. Now it was sparse, almost industrial, its walls stripped to plain white and the furnishings all of chrome, glass, and white plastic. The desk in the corner was a modern data desk, plain and unadorned. The only decoration in the place was an abstract light print hanging on the wall behind the desk. Seated at that desk was a woman of indeterminate adulthood, neither young nor quite middle-aged, with silvery blonde hair drawn back in a bun and a sober gray suit. She smiled, but it didn't quite go to her blue eyes, and stood up. "Ah, good afternoon, Miss Hutchins," she said. "Please, sit down. You're right on time. I appreciate that." Kate nodded and went to a chair. For a moment, she wondered why the new counselor didn't offer to shake hands. Kate wasn't particularly keen on it, but most people did it as a matter of course, when she noticed the woman was wearing gray leather gloves. Gleaming on her lapel was the golden badge of the Psi Corps. Kate paused, almost seated, and regarded her for a moment with a look of guarded puzzlement. "Is there something wrong?" inquired Miss LeClerc pleasantly, resuming her own seat. Caitlin shook her head and finished sitting. "You'll have to excuse me if the first few minutes are rather clinical," said Miss LeClerc as she paged through a file folder on her desk. "This is 1 o'clock, so you must be Caitlin Hutchins?" "Hmm," said Kate, nodding. "It says here you have a moderate to severe speech impediment," the counselor went on, "but it doesn't say what type."
I stutter,
said Caitlin. Miss LeClerc raised an eyebrow. You certainly do," she said. Not unkindly, but Kate thought it was a rather boorish thing for a counselor to say all the same. The woman seemed almost nervous about something. Her apprehension was grating on Kate's nerves, picked up by her Zanshin-trained awareness. Kate supposed the prospect of meeting over 400 students in 3 weeks would make anybody feel a little stressed, and resolved to cut the new counselor a bit of extra slack.
"Do you find that it makes participating in classes difficult?" asked Miss LeClerc curiously.
No, said Kate. It's worse with strange jurors.
The teachers.
She flipped a hand.
I'm used to them.
The counselor nodded. "That's good," she said. "I haven't had time to review everyone's file in any detail, you understand, so I'm sorry if I'm covering old ground here. This mentions some difficulties with your roommate last year, a Miss Hiroe Ogawa, who is apparently not a student at the Institute any longer. Can you give me any background information on that?"
Not much to tell,
said Kate. Hiroe wasn't well.
She eventually went to a hospital.
"But not before almost driving you crazy, hmm?
asked Miss LeClerc with a smile. It was supposed to be conspiratorial, but ended up just looking kind of forced and strained. Despite the fact that this had been pretty much exactly the situation, the way the counselor was putting things had Caitlin's back up a bit by this time, and she found herself bristling in defense of her old roommate.
She was sick,
she said. She couldn't help herself. Miss LeClerc seemed to realize her misstep. She nodded and abandoned the subject. But you've had no troubles with your current roommate? I see you weren't scheduled to have one. Miss Tencho, yes, was assigned to you at the last minute. How did you feel about that?
Fine,
Kate replied. She wondered what Miss LeClerc was trying to accomplish with this line of questioning. Was she so desperate to help people that she felt the need to go fishing for problems rather than letting the students bring their troubles to her? Miss LeClerc waited for a few seconds, apparently convinced that Caitlin was working herself up for a longer answer than that. When it became apparent that Kate had no intention of elaborating, she collected herself with visible effort, flipped through the folder, and said, "Miss Tencho's file indicates that she was recently orphaned and displaced by raider activity on the Outer Rim. Has she had many difficulties adjusting?"
You'd have to ask her,
said Kate evenly. She was really trying to have patience, but this was getting downright absurd. Before long, she feared she wouldn't be able to keep her annoyance from showing. Of course. Miss LeClerc put the folder aside, squared herself up, sighed, and said,
I'm sorry. Can I call you Caitlin?
If you'll like, said Kate, trying her best not to sound like she'd prefer the woman didn't.
Well, I'm sorry, Caitlin, said Miss LeClerc. I'm trying to do too much too fast. This is really just an orientation meeting. I think it's very important to put faces to names as quickly as possible in a new setting. I can't very well help anyone if I have to look up their name when they come to see me. But I must admit, this is the largest school I've ever worked at, 454 students, and, well, it's a little overwhelming. I'm afraid I'm making a bad start of it.
Caitlin possessed enough grace not to nod and confirm the counselor's suspicion. Instead, she simply put on her polite look and waited.
Maybe I should tell you a little bit about myself, said the counselor, to make you feel more at ease. Would that help?
It might. Well, I'll give it a try then, said Miss LeClerc with a game but rather clinical smile. My name is Martine LeClerc. I'm a licensed and bonded commercial telepath, rating P5. I was born in Quebec City, Canada. Have you ever been to Quebec?
Kate shook her head.
More of an Ontario fan myself, she replied, then smiled apologetically.
Sorry.
Miss LeClerc chuckled and waved a hand. Oh, don't worry. That's all well in the past. We're one big happy dominion these days. I'm actually surprised you know about all that. It was a long time ago.
My father,
said Kate, then paused as the length of the explanation she'd just begun daunted her. But Miss LeClerc caught on and nodded.
Of course. He remembers those days firsthand, doesn't he?
Well, at any rate, I graduated from the Université de Québec in 2390, got my master's at Harvard in 92, and I've been working as an academic and professional counselor ever since. My last assignment was as an employee counselor at Raytheon, but I wanted to get back into student counseling again. Students are our future and all that. They needed someone on short notice for this assignment, and, well, here I am.
Kate nodded. What was she expected to say? Congratulations? It's so lucky for you that Mr. Hanley's cortectic fever flared up and forced him out of the job he loved?
I know it's a difficult adjustment to make, getting used to a new counselor. As much of an adjustment as it is for me to get used to my new patients, said Miss LeClerc with a smile. But please, I'm here to help you. That's my only job here, is to help the students. So if there's anything bothering you, anything you feel like you need to get off your chest, I'm here. My office is completely confidential. Nothing said here will ever leave the room. And all my talents and training are here. She said more, but her audience didn't hear it. When the counselor had spoken the words, need to get off your chest, something invisible had pricked the zone of Caitlin Zanshin, invading the perimeter of her extended senses. Her father had taught her years ago, as part of her training in the Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu, that her senses could be extended some way beyond the physical through the force of her ki, her life energy, for lack of a better standard translation. Once the technique was learned, years of practice had made it instinctive. Now, even with her eyes closed, even in her sleep, Caitlin was alert to any change in her surroundings, any potential threat. Utena had noticed the phenomenon in action many times during their sparring sessions and their one duel to date. The way Caitlin could sense things she couldn't see, sometimes feel things coming before they happened. Now that ability served her again, in a completely different and unexpected arena. There was no doubt about it. When she'd made the statement about getting things off one's chest, the counselor had touched Caitlin's mind, scanning her surface thoughts without permission. No doubt expecting that, as a non-telepath, the girl would never notice she had been violated. For, even though it was only a minor surface scan, that's what Caitlin took it as. A violation. Cold anger swelled inside her. Another thing her father had taught her was to have great respect for the sovereignty of the individual, in one's person, one's effects and property, and especially one's mind. Hers had been invaded once before, an experience which had made her all the more aware of how precious a thing that sovereignty was, and how carefully and zealously it had to be guarded on all its fronts. It was as much for the sake of that, as for the pursuit of mastery, that she had trained so hard to improve her state of Zanshin. The irony here was that the Psi-Corps themselves made much of the fact that Earth Alliance law forbade telepathic scans without the informed consent of the person being scanned. It was the cornerstone of the trust the Psi-Corps is your friend, message they'd been pushing in their public relations materials since the organization's founding. Without a word, Kate got to her feet. She fixed the counselor with such a cold look of fury that Miss LeClerc stopped nattering, first looking puzzled, then alarmed as it sank in what must have made Kate so angry. Never, said Caitlin in an icy, flat voice, do that again. Then she turned and, without another word, left the office. Utena saw her coming across the West Street footbridge like a thundercloud, swung into step with her, and asked, how'd it go? Not good, Kate replied, her voice still tight with anger. Call a meeting. The vice president of the Institute Duelist Society did as she was told without demur. The message went out via the campus data network, and at 5 o'clock the duelists and their hangers-on were assembled in the main hall of Alden Memorial. Caitlin arrived a few minutes later, having stayed behind after Galactic History 204 got out in order to discuss a point with the professor. Even now she still looked angry, the lines around her eyes strained. She put down her bag in the corner, strode across the room, and faced the assembled duelists. Miss LeClerc is a telepath, she informed them.
Nice of Dean Weatherwell to mention that in his letter, said Moose.
Telepaths are quite often employed as counselors, Amanda observed calmly. What of it? While she was telling me how
much she wanted to help me. She scanned me without asking.
Amanda's face hardened. "That," she said in a cooler tone of voice, "is different."
"That's illegal, that is," Devlin Carter noted indignantly. "You ought to report her to the dean. They've rules about that kind of thing, eh, what?"
Kate shook her head.
It'd be my word against hers, she pointed out. "And normals aren't supposed to be able to feel a surface scan."
"Then how did you?" wondered Miki Kaworu.
"Katsu Jinkenryu," said Caitlin, and left it at that. "I don't feel like explaining it to the dean."
"You should at least tell Miss Montaigne," said Mia Ausa thoughtfully. "She might not be able to do anything about it, but she should at least be informed. She is the Dean of Student Life." Again, Kate shook her head. "No," she said, "I'm just going to put it behind me and never see that woman again if I can help it. I just wanted to warn the rest of you. Watch yourselves when you see her."
"I'm damn well not going to see her," said Utena angrily. "And if Dean Weatherwell has a problem with that, he can go to hell."
"I think I'll keep my appointment," said Azalin, a slow smile spreading across her face. "I can think of all sorts of interesting things to think."
A faint smile played at our Dorothy Wainwright's lips.
"She's welcome to scan me all she wants," she said.
They discussed it for almost an hour, back and forth, breaking up into little groups and comparing the timing of their appointments. As they did so, Miki broke away from the group he was in and went to the far corner, where Kate and Utena were standing deep in conference.
"Caitlin?" he inquired in a murmur.
Kate turned, gave him an inquisitive look, and he lowered his voice still further to ask,
Are you all right? An unauthorized scan, maybe it's presumptuous of me, but..."
He trailed off, looking uncomfortable, as if searching for some way to say what he was trying to say, without coming right out and saying it. Kate smiled for the first time that afternoon and put her hand on his shoulder.
Thanks, she said softly. "It's okay. I got out of there before it could get too bad. But
she leaned closer to him then, eyes closed, and kissed his cheek gently.
"Thanks for asking," she murmured.
Then, brisker, she patted his shoulder, said to everyone, "Come on, you guys. Dinner time." Turned and left the auditorium with some of the spring restored to her step. Utena gave him an impressed little look and a half-jesting thumbs up, then went after her.